Emma Southend is a force all of her own when it comes to setting the record straight on all things regarding ancient Roman history. I have learnt so much from her work, and I'm thirsty for even more juicy sources of lore. She has a way of writing that is blessed by the gods, and it speaks to the reader or listener in a very nuanced way. This is not a typical academic's piece that requires constant footnote checking or regular caffeine-fueled timeouts to be able to deal with the vast flow of information. This is history as a story that talks of ancient times in the modern tongue. What we would today consider a shit thing to do is described by Emma Southend as a shit thing to do. Rome's patriarchal ways are disturbing in the extreme. The way they treated normal citizens, working classes, and especially slaves is horrifying. They cared not one bit for human life. What really scares me is how much of the bad of ancient Rome I see in modern politics all around the world. This book reminds us that power, unchecked, is the biggest threat to society. Emma Southend pulls no gladius in her account, and it is rich in detail and feeling as a result. If you try out the audiobook, you are in for a treat, because narrator Sophie Ward is amazing, and her voice is captivating. My compliments to both Emma and Sophie on their work. Thanks also to Greg for his thrillingly understated reviews and commentary. Tuna Mike clocking out. Rise up.
Dung parodit kod jok mawuoye tu under mic. Seche tin sud buta wawinjie tu under mic. Wala wachokre, wabed piny, bi wawinje. Ero chako, domomitndi, tu under mic. Podcast makende.
I'm very happy to say that I'm joined again by Greg for the continuing saga that is our book club. Hello, Greg. How are you?
Oh, very well, thanks. Second, how are you?
Yep, I'm me, and I'm here. I have no idea how else to express my presence at this particular moment, but there we are. Anyway, this was my book, right? That I had.
Very much so.
Yeah, well, not my book, it was my suggestion. So
it was your if, yes.
Indeed. And as those of you cunning strategists will already have known, having read the title of this podcast, you'll know that we are talking about A Fatal Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, written by Emma Southend. Now, when I first started reading this, listening to this, the first thing I thought was, Greg is gonna love it. And was that primary thought correct?
Oh yeah, I very much liked it. I really, really liked it. I thought it's a very, very good read or good listen, particularly because of the narrator, who I thought was wonderful. And really did justice to the scriptures given. I can't get my head around just how brilliant her voice suited the text. It was ideal.
Yep. So that's a shout out to Sophie Ward, who was the narrator of this particular audiobook. I imagine that she, and I'm probably completely wrong because I haven't got a clue, but I imagine she probably sat down with Emma Southend, and I'm not sure if I should call her Professor Emma Southend or not, because she's a professor, I believe, but she probably sat down with Emma Southend and asked her what kind of tone the book was written in, or, you know, how she would like it to be narrated, in what style and so on. And she probably got a lot of good tips from Emma Southend on that basis, because I've watched a video interview of Emma Southend talking about this book, but also talk about the next one, which goes more into murder in the Roman Empire through the stories of 21 women, I believe. So that's definitely going to be one of my very that's gonna be one of my books to read or listen to in 2025. And Emma Southern has very much this modern approach to how she communicates in general. So she doesn't, if you ask somebody, okay, can you tell me what your thoughts are on how a professor would look, especially a professor of antiquity, she would not in any way represent that.
Okay.
So the way she speaks, and in general, the way she dresses and so on, it's a brilliant way for me, in my opinion. If people are taught by somebody like Emma Southern, then they are interested in the topic. And that's what I got from her interview, and that's definitely what I got from the book.
Okay, yeah. Just generally, the thing about the book, which really, I really, really liked, is it doesn't do the thing which most Roman books or books about Rome do, which is they list the facts and they tell you this happened, this. It's quite, it makes them, in the end, quite dry. Because this is not a work of fiction. This is all stuff that actually happened. But what she does is she drills down into it and she makes you think of it from a sort of current point of view. So when you're thinking about people in, you know, people being crucified or people, you know, people in amphitheaters getting killed, she tells you it's not murder in the Roman eyes, in the eyes of the Romans, because for them, murder is only something that happens to people who have dignitas. Whereas we see murder as murder. It doesn't matter where, at least in the West, or at least in the UK, or you know, the countries that we think of as being law-abiding. Whoever you murder, it's murder. It doesn't matter how you do it. But it really mattered to the Romans. And she really gets that across. And she gets that across time after time after time. So you really get a feel of the fact that the most, if there's one message to take from this book, if you didn't have dignitas in Rome, you didn't have a life. That's the takeaway message, really. And that means that you had no rights. If you're a slave, clearly, you know, they have no rights. The slaves could be killed on a whim. But if it didn't just extend to slaves, it was also people who were in certain jobs, like actors even. Actors now, you know, are treated very well. But in Roman times, they were treated not much better than slaves. So some bakers, apparently, she mentions, and actors and prostitutes and some other what they were considered lower class forms of employment. These people were not treated as citizens, even if they were. They couldn't bring cases to court as other citizens could, and basically had their rights removed.
Yeah, what I found to be a really interesting vehicle for exploring the history of the Roman Empire was she pursued it through murder, as you point out. And it's fascinating that in the first few hundred years of the Roman Empire, murder wasn't even a crime. And at no point, she points out later on, is the concept of manslaughter anywhere introduced. So one of the examples that she brings up, and it's probably going to sound stupid, spoiler alert for a book about Rome, but I mean, when she talks about how somebody can kill someone in the act of robbing them, but if the person that robbed them can prove that, no, but I didn't mean to kill him, I only wanted to rob him, and then they'll say, okay, well, in that case, just give us back what you robbed and go on your way. I mean, obviously, not if they killed a senator, but I mean, there's no concept of distinction between murder and manslaughter. And what I found to be particularly interesting from this, because I've read quite a bit about Rome, but I'd never, ever actually thought what kind of laws did the Romans have? Because so much of European law, I mean, in Germany, a lot of the principles of law are based on Roman law. Obviously, they've added stuff, as in it's not like there's no murder and so on. But so much of what the European nations got from Rome, even from their legal system, was entered into European countries' legal systems. And I found myself questioning the logic of that.
The thing that I sort of remember from when I was studying Roman stuff, when I was doing A level in Roman history, it's so you're right. They didn't have a law for manslaughter. That the Greeks actually did have it, but the Romans didn't.
Okay.
So I think with the Romans, it was so much down to if you could have your case argued in court. And it was pretty much the arguer who did the winning of the case. So if you had Cicero fighting your corner, you could literally be standing over the body with the bloody knife, and having told the guy, yes, I damn well did it, like happened in Blackadder. But Cicero would be able to argue, probably not only get you off, but get the other guy to pay you $5,000 for wasting your time. If you had a really good lawyer, he could probably get you off. So that was almost more important than what you've done.
Well, this was practically the case in the Battle of Bovillae, wasn't it, with regards to Clodius and Milo? So,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Clodius was, I believe, he was an enemy of
Cicero. Yeah.
Cicero.
Milo wanted to bring him back from exile. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then obviously, Milo's gang met Clodius's gang and blah, blah, blah. The rest is history. But exactly as you say, and Emma Southam also explains in the book that Cicero didn't even try to argue the fact that who was to blame or not. The argument was basically, but it was probably a good thing that he was killed. You know? And that wasn't really the only time that that's been used in one of these so-called trials, which really makes you wonder, because what this book really made me do, and I don't want to talk about or reveal too much about it, because it would be unfair to ruin anybody's initial experience with either the writing itself, or if they listen to the audiobook, their enjoyment of that particular representation either. But what I got from this book, and at some points I was laughing, I just, for the same reasons that you expressed, but at other points I was seething. Because I drew a lot of similes from what kind of happened about 2,000 years ago, or 1,800 years ago, or 2,200 years ago, to what we experience today in some parts of the world. And I'm talking about the UK, I'm talking about the US, I'm talking about other parts of Europe, where essentially people can simply more or less incite a mob to conduct their political business. And there was a great part in the book where she basically talks about how murder had become an everyday occurrence. This is something I would never have associated with Rome, because I always thought it was so well organized. Gang violence had become a normal part of life in Rome by 52 BCE, so before the Common Era. I would never have imagined gang violence.
That I did know, and especially so Caesar used that to his advantage. So Caesar himself made himself a populist, and by doing so he appealed to certain gangs, and he got them on side. He got voted into positions of power by use of the gangs. So not only were the gangs there, they were powerful in their own way, because they could get you voted into certain posts. This is, of course, before emperors came along, and then that power would have diminished somewhat with under the emperors, because they don't really, no one gets voted into anything of any real significance without an emperor's say so. So before the era of say Caesar and after Augustus, the power of the gangs was probably greater. And they get, remember, tribune of the plebs was also a very, very important role. And gangs had not control over that, but they could get stuff vetoed that the Senate wanted to do by use of the tribune of the plebs. So again, that in the earlier part of Roman history, that's a very important position, and gangs have access and some control over those too.
Yeah, and I mean, for me, it smacks of certain, should we say, parts of, you know, even the modern political arena. We've got, I mean, we had during the in the summer, the Farage riots, where basically you had this this idiot citing hatred and stirring up a hornet's nest and having people go out into the streets to, I don't know what kind of justice they thought they were going to get, but in most cases they were simply attacking innocent people. And then the response in some corners has been that, oh, that these people have been put in prison for nothing, for defending their communities. And it just basically smacks of the exact kind of stuff which was spoken about in the book, where basically people from nothing created enmity with other groups and other people just because they could.
Yes. But I think that's always been the case, hasn't it? You know, that's just, it's one of the flaws of being human. You identify something either in yourself or someone else that you dislike. Usually someone else, and if enough of you get together, you can feel as though something needs to be done about it, and that's kind of the, you know, what it is that the Farage did, and what happened in Rome. I mean, it famously happened against Christians in Rome, and Nero with his candles and, you know, things like that. And first of all, of course, the way they did it is they would make the Christians, per se, in this instance, the enemy, by saying, look at what they're doing. They don't believe in our gods, blah, blah, blah. So instead of arguing with them, we're just going to burn them or crucify them. You know, they're misbehaving. That's it. And it's not just Christians. You know, what the sack of Jerusalem in about 70 AD was horrific by all accounts. And they literally left no man, woman or child alive. Once they've been done. So, you know, the Romans were experts in identifying people that they wanted to do ill to, and then doing ill to them. And it's funny that whenever people think of Rome now, they either think of, you know, one or other film. You know, it could be Gladiator or you know, Spartacus, whatever. And you get a sense of injustice from those films, of course you do, but it's so well dressed up and so nobly sort of hidden behind, you know, behind great lines and great acting and stuff. You never really get the feel of what it was like for someone to live in ancient Rome if they didn't have rights.
Yeah.
I think,
yeah,
if anything, I Claudius probably showed that best. I'll never forget the scenes when Caligula was emperor in I Claudius. That, you know, he was terrifying. And it would have been absolutely terrifying to have lived under Caligula and Nero as well, but particularly Caligula. The man was just insane.
But none of these guys are particularly nice, are they? I mean, what was also quite interesting was that there was nowhere you could go. If you had been wronged, there was nowhere to turn. They didn't care. It was, yes, your problem. Yeah. As in, murder was not a state issue. It was a personal thing. And for me, the first time I heard that in the audiobook, when it just made me think, what? What do you mean? You know, how is that even possible? And yet, as you say, you know, when people normally think about Rome, when I think about Rome, I think about obviously the architecture. I think about the literature. I think about the sophisticated philosophy. You know, I think about all of these things. But it's completely wrong, as in, or it's there, but to be honest, it's actually there to cover up, or at least it's been represented in a way to cover up all of the actual barbarity of, yes, what Rome was.
But isn't that always the case? Again, this, you know, as we know, history is written by the winners, and Rome were pretty much always the winners. So their history was written by other Romans. They're gonna accuse historical figures, perhaps, whom they might not be fond of, to say he did bad. You know, Suetonius, he obviously, a lot of the stuff we have comes from his 12 Caesars. And historians know to take what Suetonius says with a pinch of salt, because a lot of the time it's hyperbole and trash talk. but it's very appealing and compelling trash talk. You don't get that sense of what is going on in Rome as being injustice, but of course it is. Especially during the time of the emperors, where you have one guy in control of everything, and even a senator in those days couldn't be safe. If Tiberius as a senator calls you as a senator to go visit him in Capri, you had about a 50% chance of flying off a mountain, flying off a cliff in the next 48 hours. You never had an idea if you're coming back again. You'd take care of your affairs back at home in Rome, and then you'd leave, because as far as you were concerned, you might be taking a trip off a cliff. He did that not for any particular reason, just because he apparently liked to see the look on their faces.
Yeah, I'm not even sure. I mean, what was also amazing was the sense of humor that came out through the book. If you are somebody of a very delicate disposition, I'm not sure if this book is for you. Because some of the descriptions provided of punishments, some of the descriptions provided of events that actually took place are quite horrifying.
Yes.
One of the things that I found to be, and the way this was introduced was also, the sense of humor is fantastic. But basically, the worst ever punishment in Rome was to put people in a bag.
Yeah.
With a snake, a chicken, a dog, and something else. I can't remember what.
Cockerel, I think.
Yeah.
And there are a few unpleasant animals.
Yeah.
And then chuck it in the river. This is the punishment for patricide.
Yeah.
Which was considered the very worst crime. Because the paterfamilia, the father of the family, was sacred, and it was always so. As the father of the family, you could choose who to kill in your household. it was not a crime, because they are pretty much considered to be your chattels, whether it's your wife or your children. It's a strange anomaly they had in those days, but that's how they thought about it.
Yeah, which kind of...
I was just going to say, if you think about it, we do have some cultures, even now in the world, where it's not quite that stark, but you can see the difference that the male head of a household would perceive to have over the female head of a household, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to be judgmental, but I mean, what you're talking about is especially correct, at least from what we have heard of in the West about, for example, Afghanistan at the moment, where essentially women have been sentenced to a very short existence in Afghanistan, because they're not allowed to see a male doctor if they have problems. And women are not themselves allowed to study to become doctors either.
Right.
So who does a woman go to if she has a medical issue? And quite clearly, that's something that's been curtailed. On top of that, women are not allowed to speak in public places. They're not allowed to sing. They're not allowed to be heard in Afghanistan. So it's probably not too different from
this was
what we've just heard about. Yeah, the Rome. Yeah, what happened in Rome. Yeah.
I'd say, if anything, women in Rome would probably have had more rights than women in Afghanistan do now. It just didn't extend as far in terms of legal recourse. To violence at home. It's difficult to read some of these some of these things, and as you mentioned, there's certain punishments being really, really quite harsh. The one I recall was the fellow who was fed to lampreys, the chap called Pollio. Augusta had come to dinner, and his slave had dropped a goblet, and he wanted to kill the slave in a way that would impress Augustus. So he fed him to lampreys, who basically, in the book, is a beautiful description that I can't give myself, but they're basically a machine of sharp teeth that does nothing but grind meat, is how she kind of described a lamprey. This slave was fed to them. But the guy, he did get some justice, because apparently Augustus was not impressed at all. And instead, he had his retinue smash every goblet in his man's house. It didn't help the slave much, but at least I guess Augustus felt better.
With regards to the issue of slavery, the first ever law in Rome that referred to murder was actually with regards to possessions. So if somebody were to kill somebody else's slave, then that was a crime, because you were essentially removing from the other person the value that that slave represented to them. And the crime would be therefore remuneration for their financial loss.
Yes.
Yeah, without a care for the slave or indeed the slave's family.
Absolutely. No.
Yeah.
That is the case. I mean, again, it goes back to this idea that slaves had no rights because they were chattels, they were possessions. If you killed a man's slave, you'd be doing no different than killing their cow. That's how they saw it. So, in fact, they'd probably get more for a cow or a horse than a slave.
Yeah. And there was also this other example where basically two or three, maybe as many as six slaves had had enough and they went after their master, but they didn't succeed. And the custom there was that the master essentially had the right to kill every slave in his household if anybody or any one of them laid a finger on him, basically. And right. In the case of this particular master, he had 240 slaves put to death.
Yep. If any slave killed a master, then killed their master, then tradition was that all the slaves, the households, should be killed. So yeah, I remember it was 400 slaves were killed because they turned on a master. But it was incredibly rare, as you can imagine, because of the punishment that a slave would lift their hand to their master for that reason.
Well, apparently they talked about it in the Senate because it was they really didn't want to have that much blood and that much death. Because obviously, even if they're slaves, it kind of has an effect on the mood of the town, doesn't it? So they really weren't up for it. But what they decided in the end was essentially, we cannot allow slaves to think for one second that if they try to do this, that they may have a hope of succeeding. And so they were more afraid that other slaves would try to rise up. So they were happy to be extremely brutal and barbaric and kill all of these innocent people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course. But unfortunately, that did happen on occasion.
I mean, we're talking about also, because you mentioned it at the beginning, so you're talking about people with dignitas and so on. And one of the early examples in the book is where she talks about the landed against the unlanded, the populares and the optimates.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I read this nowadays because I always like to kind of refer back to the present time. So I read this nowadays to you've got the elite and then you've got basically the working class. And now, obviously, we've got a number of different layers in current society. I believe the fact that we've got more layers in current society is the way that the elite manages to maintain control, because it's extremely difficult to continuously rebel against the different levels that are above you, because the higher you go up within this sort of hypothetical ranking within society, the more people have themselves to lose. And so therefore they kind of push back. So if, for example, you were to have the working class rebel or create a revolution, as it were, to try to change the system, the immediate group, maybe the lower middle class, will sympathize with them. But the middle class itself will push back against that, and they will protect the upper classes that lay in the background. But in the case of Rome, there were simply these two options. You had the optimatis, this elite, and then you had everybody else.
I think they had another level. So they started, of course, with the senators, and they are the highest echelon of society. Forgetting Caesar at this point, because we start a little bit earlier than that. But then they introduced the one people who could afford to buy horses, mm-hmm. and if you could afford a horse, you could. You could start to enter the Senate, and these people became became very rich. They were largely traders or business owners, and they could be extremely wealthy. So they were allowed access to the Senate, but their numbers were limited because they, you know, obviously the senators wouldn't want to dilute their power too much. But they wanted new blood in because they understood that they couldn't run everything themselves. They needed to have new blood. So this new level was sort of created. But they knew their place. Again, they weren't quite of the same level as senators, but they were above those who didn't have land. Now, you mentioned land, and that's one point which she touched upon in the book as well, because there was a time when, again, a tribune of the plebs, there was a famous family who were trying to pass land back to the people. And the senators weren't having any of it and ended up murdering both brothers. But the whole transaction of it was...
But these are the brothers, Gracchi, is that...
It was the Gracchi, yeah. The whole thing was that they wanted for soldiers who went away to fight, when they came back, not to be indebted to the senators and have to sell their farms to them in order to pay those debts. Soldier salaries just weren't enough for them to live. You know, they had to kit themselves out, pay for their own, you know, pay for their own survival and their own kit and their swords and everything. And when they came back, if they didn't have enough money to pay the debts that their family had accrued, their wife and kids, they'd probably already have been turfed out and their house had been taken and their land. And they'd end up as no better than serfs. So to try and combat this, they said the tribune of the plebs and even the Senate set up a rule that only a certain amount of land could be owned by any one person, any one individual, and then their sons could be added some more. And the senators did not like this at all, and they actually ended up killing them both to stop this law being enacted.
Was this the example that was given where the senators themselves killed them in the Senate?
Well, it was a temple. They rushed them. And they'd hold themselves up in a temple, their supporters, and the senators rushed in with, I think, wooden pikes and things and just beat them to death.
Yeah, what can I say?
Well, there's not much we said to that, really.
That's, yeah, luckily modern day members of parliament are a little bit more chaste when it comes to that kind of behaviour. But you referred earlier as well, there are so many elements to this book, and I want to give a little bit of a flavor of some, but not all of them. People really have to buy this book, in my opinion, read it at least. And if they do have the opportunity to listen as well, then they'll get the benefit of both Emma Southern and Sophie Ward. But you mentioned before the power of the master, the patriarchal structure of society. This is very well represented by how women were treated in the Roman period. And I believe Emma Southern has also followed this book up with another book, which I believe has been published already, which is about, I don't know the exact title, but it's to do with murder in the Roman Empire through the lives of 21 women. And it strikes me, again, bringing it back, not necessarily only to modern times, but throughout history from Roman times. And maybe here also you can give me a bit more information on the basis of ancient Greece, if there were any, if it was different then, there. But the way that women are kept down, the way that the patriarchal system is protected at all costs, is indicative of, in my opinion, the collapse of the empire. And also that combines with the way that the slaves were treated too. For me, the reason why these empires have not been able to exist is because of the way in which they have treated these groups, women, working class people, or the majorities, or the plebs, as it were, in this case. And it simply allowed the people at the top to engage in such levels of corruption, to basically feel that they were able to do anything that they wanted to and with impunity. And so it also tells me what we're currently living today, when we see what I consider to be pretty much the collapse of the fabric of society. It's also to do with this, I think.
Do you mean more generally, or are you specifically talking around sort of the times of the emperors and things as well? Because they had that, she mentioned that term, majestas, which was when an emperor sort of felt he'd been wronged, his majestas had been wronged by someone. So in those instances, for example, she mentions that Vespasian, who was considered to be a good emperor, he only had one person killed for majestas. And that guy, the guy was called Priscus, and he refused to acknowledge him as emperor, so he had him killed. But it was only the one. Whereas, of course, for much less than that, you know, the likes of Tiberius and Caligula and Nero, they murdered, had dozens or more, scores of people killed for what wouldn't even be considered an act against or to question majestas on their part. However, they could take anything as a slight. Well, they were considered to be weaker emperors in the sense that they, because they felt as though their position was weak, they had to, they had to take a stricter line.
Yeah, well, she refers to Vespasian and says that he didn't, as you say, didn't like killing, as it were, domestically, but he was an absolute bastard when he was leading his military campaigns, and he practically killed anything and anyone that he could. With regards to the other leaders or emperors, you're right. She mentions how, oh, you're not my best friend anymore. Boom, stick it to you. Or somebody has a dream and he dreamt that he didn't like the other person, and boom, that's it. Then you should kill him. I think these are some of the examples that you're talking about. I meant a little bit more in general, in a sense that in any society where you've got such an unfair advantage, or such a specific unfair advantages, A, from the perspective of the elite, but on top of that as well, you've got gender inequality to its most maximum extent. And then also the fact that the working classes have zero rights. They just simply do not exist. As in, we only know about some examples of violence against slaves because they are communicated almost as jokes. There was this one example where they were talking about in the Roman baths, a slave wanted to get the attention of one particularly dignitary because a senator had walked in and wanted to meet with this person. And so the slave approached this guy, and the person turned around, and because he didn't want to, for him, it was an insult to be bothered by a slave. He turned around and tried to whack the slave. The slave moved and he ended up whacking the senator. And it's only because these kinds of things happen that we have this record now of exactly how slaves were treated. Or there was another example where they gave, I think it was again a senator, but it might have been somebody else. Somebody was so angry that something had happened, he simply stabbed his slave in the eye.
Well, that's what I mentioned, because he was within reach.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. His crime was to be within reach of Hadrian.
Which is unbelievable, obviously, for us nowadays looking at it. But, I mean, this is the kind of thing that we would look at, we would read and be absolutely disgusted by. But for me, this is why empires, in this sense, had to come to an end, because this is just simply not a sustainable model. There were any number of, I don't know, however many millions of slaves at any one time in Rome. There was no way they could manage this number of people in the way that they treated them.
No, well absolutely. You mentioned the sort of gender inequality, and you mentioned about Greece. I think with Greece it's slightly different, because you had a lot of city states in Greece, and they would all have had slightly different ways of treating. So a woman in Sparta would have been treated much differently to one in Athens. So, but you're right. They had a more central role, I think, women. But they still weren't allowed to vote. I mean, if you look at Athens, the great democracy of Athens, everyone sort of quotes all the time. Who's allowed to vote? It was men over 30. You know, that's the only democracy we've ever really had, and that's in terms of where a person's vote actually means something. That was a time when a person's vote meant something, because they got to vote. They went to the demos and put everything to the vote there for that period of time. It didn't last very long, but that's the only time we've had any real democracy. And again, women were excluded.
So then again, it wasn't real democracy. No. I just find it fascinating that for however many thousands of years of existence, that humans still haven't managed to overcome this inherent weakness, where some group manages to justify to itself that for some reason men are more important than women. And it's never actually been the case. It never should have been the case. It definitely is not the case. And I'm kind of wondering what it's going to take for this to actually be completely thrown to the wayside. But I can't see it happening, to be honest, unfortunately. And I'm looking forward to reading this, the next book that comes out by Emma Southam, because I'm kind of hopeful that it really has more of an impact than this book did. I really feel people have to get into the history of the inequality, gender inequality, because they really have to understand how unfair society has been throughout the ages. I mean, because today when we talk about gender inequality, people think this is like it's a new thing. People talk about it like, yeah, oh, you keep going on about it. Come on, it was all right 50 years ago. No, it wasn't right 50 years ago. It wasn't right 100 years ago. It wasn't even right in Roman times, when we all big up Roman times. Yeah, and I think this is what's fascinating.
Well, it's never been repaired, has it? It's always been allowed to exist. It's always been, and you know, maybe a time when they had a chance to do something about that would have been when Christianity was taking shape in the early 4th century, and Constantine perhaps could have done something about it, or the first two ecumenical synods that took place, but they didn't. Instead, they vilified womankind. I mean, the church has always been about adult men telling everyone how they should practice Christianity. Why should it be the case? You know, it's only now that we've started to have sort of women in the church over the last 50 years or so. But why should that be the case? I mean, even in Rome, I mean, in fact, the Vestal Virgins were part of the Roman culture, and they played a key role of looking after the eternal flame of Rome.
But they had to live their lives in accordance with some extremely strict.
Of course, it wasn't all fun and games for them. They had an important role in the machinery of how Rome worked, but it wasn't fun for them either. I mean, but as we're talking, Rome wasn't fun for many people at all. I mean, even the senators, it was a very hard life. You're expected from the age of about 15, 16, if your father was a senator, he'd put you forward to certain either magistracies, or more commonly, you'd be put in the army, and you might be you'd be put in an equestrian rank, or you know, you'd start off as a military tribune or something. So you wouldn't necessarily be one of the guys in the front row, but you'd be involved in the thick of it, and you'd be expected to travel to the hard marches. You'd be expected to fund yourself all this time, and you'd be expected to deliver. And if you weren't good at being a soldier, you couldn't really expect to have a very good career either in the Senate or any other positions in Rome, because you had to deliver militarily first, and that was very key to Roman life. So even the senatorial classes wasn't a fun existence.
No, and you talk about the military, I remember the first time you explained to me the meaning of the word decimation, because I used to use the word, oh, they were decimated. And for that, I kind of understood what it meant. But then one day, I think I said it, and you kind of like, do you know where that comes from? Do you want to explain, just in case people don't know?
Yeah, so again, it's a military term, and it's basically usually reserved. It's a very harsh punishment, but it's usually reserved for when either a cohort or a legion, very rarely would it be a legion, but had, let's just say, failed in battle. And if they really lost face, then their general would order decimation among that group. And it would literally be, they'd stand in a line, and he'd walk down that line or ride down that line, and every 10th man he'd indicate. And then it was the job of the other 9 in that group to beat him to death. So it wasn't just the 10% that was dying. It was the fact that it was their own friends, close friends, brothers could be, whatever. And of course, you weren't there for any choice. If you were chosen to club that guy to death, it wouldn't matter what your relationship with that person was. You'd be expected to carry that out. And it was a particularly gruesome thing. But of course, if you were in a legion where this decimation had been carried out, you would know not to mess up again. It was the harshest punishment I think I've come across in military terms.
Talking about sort of military issues, then obviously we've got to talk about weapons, as it were. And we referred earlier to the gangs and the way that they used to conduct themselves. There was this very interesting Latin sentence. There are a number of them, but this one particular I took time to make a note of. Inter arme enim silent legis, which is when the weapons come out, the law is silent. And that kind of also makes me think a little bit about, at least in the USA, the concept of the Second Amendment and how thousands of years after the fall of the Roman Empire, we still basically talk about might is right. We still haven't overcome this particular falsehood in society. As in, okay, we had Darwinism where he talked about the fit, survival of the fit and so on. But the fit doesn't always, obviously, it doesn't always only refer to strength. It doesn't only refer to brutality or the best trained in this or that, the other physical side of things. But there's also a certain level of intelligence and behavioral dynamics with regards to survival. But this concept still remains even in modern society, where if you are strong, if you are powerful, then forget the law. And we can see that being carried out in international law too. And we also see that in whenever we watch a movie from the States in self-defense and so on. You know, if somebody comes to steal something from my home and he's still on my land, I can shoot him and that's fine. And I feel this principle, essentially, when the weapons come out, the law is silent, I think in some ways, obviously changed and interpreted a bit differently nowadays, but that still holds true, I think.
I think in certain places it does, particularly, as you mentioned, America. Yeah, I find that to be quite a strange thing. And that she also mentioned as well, if we're touching upon America, that it's the one place in the West now where they still have the death penalty. And she found that quite strange, that the Americans. But she points out again, quite interestingly, that in America they try to make the death as painless as possible. And conversely, for the Romans, the pain was the point, because the fact that this person was a criminal meant they had no right to exist. So the very point of killing them was to make it as painful as possible and to act as a deterrent to others.
So yeah, there were some horrible punishments that they talked about.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, of course, the mention about killing of the father, the figurehead, father of the family, or the other one was, of course, crucifixion, which she goes into some detail about.
Oh, God, yeah.
Which is severely unpleasant, and she very very interestingly tells how we're told that the bolts are put through people's feet and hands is not accurate because it wouldn't work, and the way she describes how it's actually done, it's mind numbing.
Yeah,
the pain
it is.
That these people must have been in.
But then also they were collected. Because afterwards they were considered luck. That's why there's so few of them around.
What a memento. Unbelievable.
I don't think I could handle it. But yeah, you mentioned that about pain in punishment. You're right. It's first of all, humiliation, and then pain, and pain as long as possible, and then ultimately death. And there was one year, where the year of the three Caesars or something. I can't remember. Four Caesars.
Yeah, okay. The four Caesars, yeah.
Yeah, and how some of them are killed. I mean, it's mad the things that these people went to completely humiliate these individuals, to put them through as much pain as possible, and then ultimately kill them.
Yeah, again, the Romans were brutal, and it was a brutal place to be. And it was just as brutal if you were a Caesar. And things went wrong for you, whether it was the Praetorian Guard did for you because you didn't give them enough money, which often was the case with these guys when they were bumped off. Or, in for example, in the case of Nero, it pretty much the whole population came out for him. And, you know, he had to die at the hands of a slave, funny enough.
Yeah, who 20 years later was found essentially guilty of having killed, of killed Nero. But anyway, that's a different matter. Okay. So let's look at talk about the book in general now. Obviously, you enjoyed it. Do you think, or would you recommend this book to a history buff?
I would recommend this book to anyone who's interested in learning about history, learning about what actual life in, if you're living 2000 years ago, might have been like. If you're interested in understanding that, then this book will give you a reasonable idea. And particularly so because it looks at their views of death. So that tells you a lot about what the Roman psyche was. And what she does brilliantly is she concentrates on how death was treated when it was meted upon different people, whether it was by the state or by other individuals or by members of family. She'll give you what written sources there are, pictorial sources that are often used. I mean, she touches upon the different types of people who could be, obviously gladiatorial, but again, it's treated in a different way than what we've been taught, and certainly what we see in movies. It's much more brutal than we've ever realised. And I think she does a brilliant job in letting us know, with evidence, why things she believes were the way that she's written them. And I find, I certainly wouldn't argue about anything she's written. And I did find it very, very interesting.
Yep. How many times did you listen to it?
Just the once. Okay. Unlike you, who's done, I think you're on fourth, aren't you?
Three and a half. I listened to it three times all the way through, and then the fourth time I kind of skipped ahead to certain parts that I wanted to try to get some notes from. But I will gladly listen to it again to my heart's content, because I just find the way that the book's written, but then also the narration to be absolutely top notch. My compliments to both Emma Southam and Sophie Ward. Fantastic job. And I can't wait to listen to the next one that comes out as well, along the same lines. Okay, so this was my choice, Greg. So this brings us to then your choice for the next, and I hope we don't have to wait another 3 months or however long it took for the next one, by the way. A slight dig there. What have you got for us for the next one?
Well, this one should be easier because it's not quite as long a book. And it's called Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep by Philip K. Dick. And I thought it would be quite fun would be if we were to read the book, but also watch the film and just discuss the book and the differences in the film version, which everyone will know is Blade Runner.
Yeah, okay. Which version? Because there's more than one version of Blade
Runner.
The
original 1984, I think.
With Harrison Ford?
Yep.
Blade Runner. Okay. All right. Cool. Yeah, I'll do that. Okay. So essentially the challenge now is, what have you challenged us to do then? Because we're going to, obviously we've spoken about this in the past many times. Is the book better than the movie and so on? And in this case, what is it you want us specifically to compare?
I mean, obviously the film's a lot more famous than the book is for some reason.
I can't even remember the title of the book. I mean, so you're absolutely right with that.
So to be honest with you, I haven't seen the film for about 20 years. So I'm looking forward to seeing it again now that I've read the book.
Okay.
Right. So I'm going to read the book again, and then I'm going to watch the film. Or I might do it the other way around. I might watch the film first and then read the book again. Because I just got a very different feel from reading the book than I remembered when I was watching the film. Mm-hmm. And I want to know whether it's because I've changed from that time, or whether there is as big a difference as I believe there to be.
Yeah, I mean, obviously this is a movie, as you mentioned, which is about 40 years old. So it's going to be interesting to see how what kind of effect it has on us. I might take the opportunity also and watch the newer version, but we'll see. Because I think Harrison Ford is in the newer version too, isn't he?
He is, but playing a different part. Yeah.
Plays a different role, yeah. Okay, cool. All right. Yeah, Greg, thank you very much, as always. A great sport in undertaking the challenges that I set you, even though this one was pretty much right down your street. Yeah, thanks a lot for your time and your analysis.
Thank you. I've had a great time. And I enjoyed your book, so thanks for that too.
Two and a mic.